twinge of sadness. The abrupt change was almost worse.
"I'm sorry, Da. I lost control. I'll apologize to Gunn. I'll make it up to him. I'll let him beat me next time. He can even bloody my nose,"
Archer rambled, stopping only when his father shook his head.
"This isn't your fault, son," he said.
"What?"
Archer didn't understand. He'd been the one to lose his temper. He'd been the one who'd needed to be dragged off his own brother. He sucked in a sharp breath at the thought of what he might have done if his mother hadn't been there to stop the fight.
"You are my son," his father said, stepping closer.
He placed a hand on Archer's shoulder, the weight as heavy as a stone block.
"I know that,"
Archer said, trying to understand why he'd stated such a simple fact at a time like this. His father shook his head.
"Yes, but you don't understand what it means. Not truly."
"Then tell me."
Another shake of his father's head.
"Tell me, son, what did you feel before, when you attacked Garen?"
"Nothing. Just anger. I had him beat and he cheated. Again. I don't know why it made me so angry this time."
"What else?"
Archer tried to think.
"I saw black and red spots. I felt hot, like there were fires burning through my blood."
His father frowned, pursing his lips.
"Did you hear anything?"
What do you mean?"
His father wasn't making sense. What would he have heard?
"Like a..."
His father trailed away.
"Never mind. Give me your hand. Don't be afraid."
Why would he be afraid?
He lifted his hand and his father took it, facing his palm down. His Da's other hand extracted a small paring knife from a pocket.
"Da, what are you doing?"
"Do you trust me?"
"Yes, of course, but ow!"
The prick had been so quick he hadn't had time to flinch away. A spot of blood welled from his skin where the knife had sliced him. His father laughed, actually laughed, dropping his hand.
"Go get that bandaged, son. And control your temper next time. Agreed?"
Archer was so confused by the entire conversation that he could only nod, watching his father stride away toward the castle, leaving enormous footprints behind in the snow. Drops of crimson blood painted the snow at Archer's feet. 2 weeks later. Garen's face was healing nicely. The scabs on his lips had fallen off, leaving tiny white lines that would soon vanish. His right eye still showed a shadow of a bruise, but even that was only noticeable in direct light. In the dancing glow of the firelight, Archer could almost pretend he'd never pounded his brother into submission. His parents had continued to act odd for a few days afterward, always seeming to be watching him with narrowed eyes and tight lips, but even that had faded. Everything was back to normal, it seemed. Even Garen had moved on, though he was slightly less eager to challenge Archer in single combat, and he occasionally flinched when Archer raised a hand, even if it was only to cover his mouth when he yawned. As usual, Garen was eager for more stories from the greatest storyteller in the castle, Zelda. Their great-aunt was a trollish woman, with more wrinkles than a balled-up shirt, and yet somehow the twinkle in her eyes had always captivated the attention of her nieces and nephews. Besides Garen, Archer had three other siblings, two girls and another boy. With a few months still to go before his second name day, the youngest was Hank. He was as bald as an egg, though several light-coloured strands of hair had recently begun growing. Evidently he was the mirror image of his grandmother on his mother's side, Sabria, a woman who'd once been the queen under the rule of their grandfather, the dread king of the north. The two girls were Hope and Harmony, and they were as thick as thieves, always plotting and scheming together. Like Archer, they'd already developed wide Gaelic chins and broad shoulders. If he were to wrinkle up their faces, Archer suspected they'd look more like Zelda's daughters. Several others joined them, the two daughters of the castle mystic, Lisbeth Lorne, and her husband, the greatest swordsman in the realm, Sir David Dietrich. The Dietrich girls, as they were known, were identical twins named Liza and Zola, who'd recently had their eighth name day. Their hair was the colour of night, and they bore unnaturally blue eyes that never seemed to miss a thing. Archer's two sisters followed them around everywhere. Also present were three boys, Archer's cousins, that belonged to Commander Christoph Metz and Archer's aunt Mona. Only 3 years separated the three boys, who were all between the ages of 4 and 6. They enjoyed many pursuits, most of which involved making enormous messes and causing their father, the cleanest man Archer had ever known, great distress. Just now, they were giggling and putting handprints on his armour as he tried to polish it to a shine. Zelda had begun a familiar tale, all about the horde that had descended on the Four Kingdoms 14 years earlier, before any of them were even born. It was a long story, and by the end all four girls were asleep, along with Hank.
"I wish another horde would come," Garen said. "I would fight them all, and I would win."
"Me too," Zelda muttered. "I never knew how boring peace could be."
Archer's mother, who had settled into a spot on the floor, sipping a glass of wine, fired a glare at her aunt.
"I wish you wouldn't romanticize the fall of all things."
"Romanticize?" Zelda said, incredulous. "Perhaps you listened to a different story. Mine was all about heads being chopped off, and a battlefield dripping with blood."
"Oh, I heard you, all right. There was glory seeping from every word."
Zelda snorted, but offered no further argument, crunching down hard on a raw potato. As the Queen liked to say, Aunt Zelda could give a goat a run for its coin when it came to what she was capable of eating and digesting, as well as the sheer quantity. Nearby, one of the Metz boys had discovered a dustpan filled with soot shoveled from the fireplace, and he was using it as face paint, while his father tried desperately to wash it off with a wet rag. Eventually the tussle resulted in the tin overturning with a poof, the grey ash covering Commander Metz's face. He looked ready to faint. Archer's aunt urged her husband to go get cleaned up, while she attempted to wrangle the boys to the nearest washbasin. Archer chuckled at the scene, before turning back to where his brother was, as usual, pestering their father.
"Da, will you tell us about your greatest battle?"
Garen asked. Their father had been silent for most of the evening, content to sit and listen. Both of Archer's sisters were sprawled across his lap, each of their heads tucked into one of the crooks between his chest and shoulders. Now he shifted uneasily.
"My greatest battle was nothing next to your mother's. Did I tell you about the time she defeated and—"
"I spare with her bare hands,"
Garen said.
"Yes, Star. Only 50 times. We want a story about you."
Though Archer had voiced no request for such a story, it was true. Both he and Garen were in agreement on this point. All they knew of their father's prowess in battle was gleaned from rumour and gossip.
"I fear I've forgotten them all," he said. "I haven't," Zelda said, potato juice dripping from her chin.
"I think it's time for bed," their mother said,
clambering to her feet, scooping up Hank's sleeping form as she rose. Archer sighed. The same scene had been played out dozens of times before. Whenever they pushed for stories of their father, it was time for bed. Garen's eyes met Archer's, and there was no animosity there. Whatever had transpired in the practice yard those 2 weeks ago was a distant memory now.
"Say something,"
his brother mouthed, and Archer was reminded of something they'd discussed earlier. Archer waited several long moments, until their mother had left the room, shepherding the groggy Dietrich twins before her like a flock of sheep. This was the type of request more suited to their father, at least if they wanted to get the answer they were hoping for.
"Can we visit Uncle Bane tomorrow?"
Archer asked, hating how his voice squeaked a little at the end. Lately it had been doing that whenever he was nervous.
"Ask your mother," his father said,
carrying Archer's sisters over each shoulder like they were sacks of barley. The heaviness in his tone was much the same as if he'd said, "Ask the Queen."
"She'll say no,"
Garen complained.
"Exactly."
"It's not fair,"
Garen said.
"Why do we always have to wait for him to come to the castle? He doesn't live far away. You could come with us."
"Leave your uncle alone," their father said. "He likes his solitude this time of year. Come spring, he'll visit us. I promise. Now get to bed. If your mother finds you still down here after she's done with Hank, there'll be
frozen hell to pay,"
Garen muttered.
"Watch your language, son." "But aye, that's exactly what there will be."
We could sneak away tonight,
Garin said, when they were in bed. The room they shared was modest, their beds close enough together that they could reach out and hit each other if the need arose. On one occasion, one of them would complain about how so many rooms in the castle were empty, and yet they were stuck sharing one. Neither of them really meant it, however. Sometimes it was nice having company, especially when there was scheming to be done.
"Ma will have both our hides if she catches us," Archer said.
Though the fear of their mother's wrath was a strong motivator, in truth Archer was warm and cosy beneath his thick blankets.
"We could be back before morning. She'll never even know."
Garin's face was illuminated by a red blade of moon's light that breached the clouds, stabbing through the uncovered window.
"Have you met our mother?" "No." "Strong woman. Big fists that are good for knocking sense into her children. She's the queen. She knows everything."
"Chicken,"
Garin said, breaking the insult into two distinct words.
"You know I'm not."
"Bok, bok, bok."
Across the space, Garin flapped his elbows like wings as he squawked.
"Fine. Frozen gods of the north."
Archer threw back the bedsheets, cringing as the cold hit him. Garin whooped lightly, and both boys tugged on their trousers, thick woolen socks, four layers of shirts beneath heavy greatcoats, knit caps with drooping ears, and gloves that made their hands look as huge as bear paws. Their boots completed the ensemble, and Archer found himself grinning now, the cold forgotten as the thrill of adventure took hold.
"Ready."
He started to stand, but Garin shoved him back onto the bed, hustling past him to the door.
"Last one out the castle's an ice cube,"
he hollered. Archer gritted his teeth and gave chase, still managing to tiptoe so his boots wouldn't make too much noise. He turned a corner and almost crashed into Garin's back, pulling up just in time to stop. He was about to protest, but Garin cut him off with a finger pressed to his lips. Garin pointed to a nearby door, which stood the slightest bit ajar, the telltale flicker of lantern light dancing through the gap. Murmured voices arose, indiscernible from this distance. They would have to get closer. Practically joined at the hip, the two brothers crept closer, peeking through the tiny opening. Voices, much clearer now, spilled from the room.
"We have no evidence,"
a low voice said.
"Father,"
Archer thought.
"Boys fight. They get angry. It happens."
"Not Archer,"
another voice said.
"Mother."
"Not like that."
"Are they still talking about that day in the training yard?"
Archer had thought it was ancient history now. It had been weeks ago, a lifetime for a boy his age.
"Look again."
"Anise, you're being—"
"We need to know,"
the queen said.
"I'm not afraid, just realistic. If there's any potential that he's like you, you can help him. Don't you wish you'd had someone to counsel you all those years ago?"
"Of course, but—"
"No but. Lisbeth, can you see the boys' souls from here, or do we need to visit their room?"
Archer tensed, and he felt Garin do the same. Neither of them had even been aware the mystic was in the room. Now her presence was unmistakable as a blue eye glittered in the darkness. Archer had the urge to run, but then she said,
"I can see them,"
giving no indication to their mother that they were eavesdropping less than a stone's throw away. Through the gap in the doorway, he felt her blue eye burn into them. In truth, he'd always believed the mystic to be a phony. Garin was half in love with her, his advances tempered only by Lisbeth Lorne's husband, Sir Dietrich. The aging knight seemed to only get more capable with the sword as the years wore on, when it should have been the opposite. There were stories about him, but neither of the boys gave them much credence, as northerners were prone to exaggeration. As for Lisbeth,
"There's no such thing as magic,"
Archer thought. He wanted to believe it, despite the blue eye shining from her forehead, despite the prickling sensation he felt somewhere inside him, spreading, and then gone.
"Well," the queen said. "His soul is pure,"
Lisbeth said, her blue eye fading.
"No shadows." "None."
"See," Archer's father said. "I am the only shadowed soul in the realm."
"What does he mean, shadowed soul?"
Archer wondered.
"Fine,"
his mother said.
but we shall check again in a week. Thank you, Lisbeth.
The tall, willowy woman bowed, and seemed to float more than walk toward the door. The move was so sudden that neither boy seemed capable of moving, their feet glued to the floor. She pushed the door open, slightly wider, and then slipped out, winking a sightless eye at them as she passed. Archer let out a deep breath, stifling the urge to laugh, else they'd still be discovered. It had been a close call. Maybe the mystic wasn't so bad after all. Garen motioned for him to follow, but Archer wanted to listen some more. But then their father said, "Come hither," and their mother sighed softly.
"Frozen hell,"
Archer thought, scampering away.
"Of 5 children, not enough."
They traipsed out into the frigid night, their feet crunching on the crystallized layer of top snow. Their boots sank halfway up their calves, but their trousers were thick and designed to keep the moisture from soaking through to their skin. There were guards, of course, but the boys knew their patterns of patrol as well as their blind spots. Going through the mammothin shed was always a safe option, so long as the enormous tusked beasts were not overly disturbed by their passing. They entered the high-ceilinged structure quietly, a carpet of hay masking their footfalls. On either side, enormous leather-skinned forms swayed from side to side in their sleep. Mammothin slept standing up for some reason, their mouths releasing enormous breaths that billowed out, forming ghostly clouds in the cool air. Halfway across the long length of the shed, Archer skidded to a stop, thrusting an arm across his brother's path to bring him to a halt. Archer's heart skipped a beat, his breath catching in his throat. For their aunt, Lady Zelda, was staring right at them, her back pressed against a water barrel, which she leaned against while sitting on a pillow of hay. Neither boy breathed, wondering whether they were visible in the darkness, waiting for the reprimand. Truth be told, she looked dead.
"Is she?"
Garen started to say, trailing off. The edge of Zelda's lip twitched, and Archer almost screamed.
"She's sleeping with her eyes open," he realized.
He gestured for Garen to follow him, and they snuck past, slipping back outside. Behind the shed, Garen gasped.
"What was that?"
"A close call," Archer said.
"Why? Did you want to go back?"
"Chicken."
He made flapping motions with his arms.
"Nay, what do I have to fear from an old woman?"
Despite his brother's bravado, Archer could tell he was overcompensating. The run-in with their eccentric great-aunt had shaken Garen, a realization that made Archer grin in the dark.
"Come on,"
he said, threading his way between trees as they made their way downslope toward a service door that led without the castle. The benefit of this particular exit was that it avoided the city itself, spilling onto the empty terrain to the east of the castle. It took both of their strength to lift the heavy iron bar that prevented entry from the outside. The hinges needed to be oiled, and they froze at the great creaking sound, expecting an alarm to be raised by some vigilant night watchman. Instead, silence ruled the darkness, and they made quick work of opening and shutting the door behind them. With any luck, they would be able to re-enter via the same door, throwing the bar back into place with none the wiser.
"Shite,"
Archer said, when he saw what awaited them outside the castle walls.
"What do we do?"
An entire makeshift village blocked their path. Archer felt foolish for having forgotten the Ghazi were still encamped on the eastern tundra. Once a year, usually during the coldest winter months, their neighbours from the hinterlands would migrate southward to Castle Hill to trade. The rugged people from the hinterlands were a strange race, much taller than any of the northerners, save Archer's father, with long triangular-shaped heads and too much hair. Each year when the Ghazi first arrived, Archer and his siblings would watch them from the walls. And every year, one of them would ask why the Ghazi never came inside the castle or city. "They aren't used to being closed in," the queen would always answer. "They feel safer with room to roam." Archer thought it was odd, particularly considering the structures they built were made entirely of snow and ice. Now, he felt colder just looking upon their homes.
"Perhaps they won't notice our passing," he said to his brother. "And if they do?"
They'd all heard the stories. How before the new treaty had been signed with the Ghazi, they would kill any who crossed into the hinterlands. It was said they worshipped a great lake monster, sacrificing their children to the water goddess each year.
"Then they'll cut out your bones and gnaw on them,"
Archer said, punching him.
"And pluck your eyeballs from your head and roast them on a spittle,"
his brother retorted, offering a punch of his own.
"Guess we'd better stick close to the wall so they don't catch us."
"Guess so."
Neither boy wanting to be outdone by the other, they soldiered on, the snow growing thicker as it formed drifts against the outside castle wall. The temporary Ghazi village was still and silent. The snow began to fall in earnest, obscuring anything more than a few feet away.
"Maybe we should turn back and try again tomorrow night,"
Garen said.
"Scared?"
Archer hid his own fear behind the mocking tone in his voice.
"Course not. You? Ha! What sort of northerner would fear a little bit of snow?"
The rest of his sentence transformed into a gasp as a huge form stepped across their path. The Ghazi was more than a few heads taller than Archer, looking down on them from a face covered in fur-like hair. He wore thick skins about his entire body, save for his hands and face. Several spears were strapped to his back, poking upwards over his head like a porcupine's bristles.
"Darth Norm Gur,"
the male said, reaching back to extract a long spear from where it had been strapped to his back. The razor-sharp tip glittered dangerously in the moonlight.
"Archer,"
Garen said.
"Run."
Archer knew their only hope of survival was to split up. The slower of the two would be struck down, while the swifter would have the slimmest chance of escape. And he was determined to be the slower, though he knew he could outrun his brother any day of the year.
"Go," he said. "I'll be right behind you."
Garen looked uncertain, but then turned slightly, his gloved hands curling into fists of determination as he prepared to flee. That's when the Ghazi deftly spun the spear around, extending the blunt shaft of the weapon toward Archer.
"Darth Norm Gur,"
he said again, and then,
"Be careful on this night."
This time he spoke in the common tongue, though each word was tinged with a rough accent, scraping from the back of his throat.
"You take."
Archer realized he was still staring dumbly at the shaft of the spear. He reached up and took it, nearly dropping the weapon, which was far heavier than the Ghazi had made it look. The man nodded when Archer managed to keep it from touching the snow by gripping it with both hands. As swiftly as he had appeared in the storm, he vanished, his footfalls all but silent as he departed.
"Did you see his collar?"
Garen murmured, his voice full of awe. Archer hadn't seen much other than his life flashing before his eyes, but he tried to remember.
Yes.
The man had been wearing a silver collar with a single stone inlaid in a golden hoop. He wasn't just any Ghazi. He was their leader,
Zur.
"No one is ever going to believe us,"
Garen said as they walked northward. The storm had abated, leaving a sky full of small, meandering snowflakes that never seemed to reach the ground. The clouds had even mostly moved on, the sky speckled with stars. For the north, it was as perfect a night as there ever was.
"We can't tell anyone,"
Archer said.
"What? We must. Our friends can never know."
Archer knew he didn't always act his age, but sometimes an older brother had to be responsible. A run-in with a Ghazi was nothing to brag about. Only those appointed by the Queen herself as trade ambassadors were permitted to meet with their neighbours to the north. Garen huffed.
"The most exciting thing that's ever happened to me, and I can't even tell anyone."
"Of course you can. But first, tell Ma." Garen clamped his mouth shut, the threat sufficient to take the wind out of his sails.
"Fine. But I shall remain silent in protest. Then the world shall become a quieter place."
Garen glared at him, and then broke his vow even quicker than Archer could have predicted.
"Can I hold the spear?"
"No."
"Why not?" "Because Zur gave it to me. And anyway, you were about to run for your very life." "Chicken. Buck, buck, buck." "You told me to,"
Garen protested, shoving him and trying to reach around to grab the spear. A minor tussle ensued, with Archer holding his smaller brother off with one hand clenching the collar of his greatcoat, while the other hand struggled to cling to the shaft of the spear.
"Submit,"
Archer growled.
"You submit. Over my dead body."
For the second time on that night, Archer was unable to finish a sentence he'd started, his words cut off by a roar as a monstrous form erupted from what neither of them had considered to be more than a random snowdrift.
"Not a drift,"
Archer thought, as he scrambled backwards, both his brother and the spear forgotten in his haste to get away from the creature that now loomed before them.
A burrow.
He'd learned all about ice bears growing up, how they liked to burrow into the snow to keep warm, but not this close to Castle Hill. It was standing on two powerful legs, two black eyes staring at them, its mouth open in a snarl of teeth sharpened to dagger-like points.
"We're not supposed to run, right?"
Garin said, his voice quivering like a bowstring. Archer's mind was fuzzy, and he couldn't remember what they were supposed to do. Running seemed like the only thing to do. He shook his fear away, trying to focus.
Yes,
his brother was right. Ice bears were fast, especially on the snow where the boys would be bogged down. And if they ran, it would pursue them, unable to resist chasing its prey.
Mother fought an ice bear with her bare hands, he said.
That's only a story Dad tells us so we don't step out of line,
Garin said.
We're Garricks, remember? That's only a name.
Archer forced steel into his voice.
Aye, a name that means something. We must get to that spear. It's our only chance.
He eyed the long shaft resting in the snow, the tip buried somewhere just beneath the surface. The ice bear still hadn't moved, but the beast was closer to the weapon than they were. A distraction was what they needed.
Make snowballs, Archer commanded. This is hardly a time to play snow wars,
Garin said.
This is exactly the time. And you've always been better at packing them than I.
His eyes never leaving the bear, he scooted over to his brother, whose hands were now fumbling at the snow. He grasped one of his brother's hands, squeezing through his glove.
We're going to be fine.
He didn't know where his confidence came from, but he felt surprisingly calm.
No sudden movements.
Garin took a deep breath and then nodded. He began to pack snowballs, more controlled now.
Good,
Archer thought.
Stay here. Start throwing when I tell you to.
Before his brother could protest, he rose into a crouch and began to run toward the spear. The ice bear exploded from its haunches, accelerating into a full gallop far faster than Archer thought possible.
I'm not going to make it,
was his first thought, while his second was to shout,
"Now, Garin, now!"
His focus on the spear was so complete that he didn't even notice the snowballs whipping past him, not until one of them smacked the bear flush in the nose. It recoiled slightly and slid to a stop, which was just the advantage Archer needed. He dove for the spear, grabbing its shaft as he slid past, his momentum carrying him closer to the bear than he'd anticipated. The beast was enraged now, pawing at where the snowball had grown icy teeth and bitten his snout. It lunged at Archer, but he'd managed to find his footing and shove off. Just in time, too, as the beast collided with his shoulder, its claws raking across his face. Still, the impact was powerful, like getting hit by a stampeding cow. It threw him off his feet and twisted him around. He landed heavily in a nearby drift, stunned. Something warmed his blood, but he barely noticed, his focus on the bear which stopped, turned, and attacked. Luckily, Archer kept his head, remembering to raise his spear with two hands. His eyes widened as it became clear the beast would not stop, fully prepared to impale itself on the point to get to Archer. And then, suddenly, it stopped. Archer heard a sound, a voice.
"Hey, ice fool!"
Garin shouted.
No,
Archer breathed. But the bear had already whirled around, seeking out the taunter. A snowball zipped through the air and shattered across the beast's forehead. It snarled, shoving forward in the direction of Archer's brother, who was already bending over to scoop up another snowball, rising 5 feet of fearlessness that took Archer's breath away, even as a slash of ice-cold fear took hold, replaced just as swiftly by courage, which jolted through him like a thunderbolt, drawing him to his feet, his legs moving. Adrenaline, or was it something else thrumming through him, giving him strength and speed beyond what he'd ever been capable of before, and in the center of it all, white, hot rage. The bear was fast, but Archer was faster and lighter. Still, the distance was too short for him to make up the ground he'd lost, and he could only watch as the bear pounced upon Garin just as he hurled another icy projectile into its snout.
"Ah!"
Archer yelled, slamming his spear into the bear's back where it sunk a bare inch or maybe two. It was enough to get the bear's attention, however. The beast released a high-pitched whine, rolling away from Garin, revealing his bloodied mess of a face, his greatcoat and the layers beneath shredded, uncovering his chest, which was a mess of ribbon-like skin and blood, so much blood. He wasn't moving, his eyes closed. Spots of black and red danced before Archer's eyes, swarming with flames, and an animal scream that came not from him, but from somewhere deep inside his being, roaring through his mind, breaking to the forefront of everything until he was the spots and flames and scream and nothing else, including his former self, including Archer. He threw himself onto the bear, even as it swatted at him with a heavy, clawed paw. The blow should have knocked him askew, like before, but he simply absorbed it, a shot of pain rolling through him that was nothing next to the anger. He shoved the spear into the bear's chest, and this time it sank deeper, the tip almost hidden beneath fur and flesh. The bear roared, pummeling him with its claws, snapping at him with its powerful jaws. Archer slammed his fist into its face, even as he twisted the spear with the other hand. He felt strong, invincible, like a version of himself reconstructed of steel. Yes! Oh, yes! It felt good. He wanted to kill this thing, not just once, but twice, thrice, as many times as it took for it never to walk again, its breath taken away, its heart slowing to a crawl and then stopping altogether. He wanted it to bleed into a lake, and then he wanted it to bleed some more. His vision filled with fur and blood and coal-like eyes that grew wilder and wilder and more desperate until they faded into nothingness. He was dimly aware of the blood spattering his knuckles, which were bare. When had he lost his gloves? And his face soaking into his greatcoat, both shoulders tattered and shredded by the bear's claws. The bear's face was a bloody ruin, and yet still he pounded. He drove the spear out and shoved it back in, over and over, turning the bear's chest into mincemeat. It was no longer moving, no longer fighting him, and yet still he skewered it on his blade, pulverized it with his fists. Strong hands grabbed him from behind, dragging him back from the bear even as he continued to swing at it. He wasn't finished with the destruction, his need for blood unsated. He needed to get himself free, so he swung an elbow back, connecting with whomever held him. The someone, however, took the blow without lessening his grip. Archer elbowed him again and heard a grunt, again and again. The someone slung him down roughly into the snow, and through the spots and fire he saw who it was. His Uncle Bane, his smooth-skinned face determined but not angry. Something was glowing through his thick black hair, like a lantern hidden somewhere on his scalp. Archer instantly knew he wanted to kill this man, not because he held anything against him, but because he was alive. "Do it," that voice said, egging him on. He tried, oh, how he tried. But his uncle was far stronger than he looked, his hands pinning Archer's wrists at his sides, his knees subduing Archer's kicking legs. "I know darkness," Uncle Bane said. "I know violence. I can help you." With a speed that defied possibility, his uncle released one of his hands and landed a powerful blow to his cheek. The spots turned to stars, the fires extinguished. Archer's vision swam, fading entirely to black. "What am I?" he thought, trying to make sense of everything that had happened. And then nothing. The voices seemed to rise from the depths, distant murmurs at first, and then clarifying, taking shape in Archer's ears. "Always knew it was a possibility. Though I'd hoped..." "Mother?" Archer said. No, he hadn't said anything. The words stuck in his head. "Hoped what?" "Father?" Again his lips failed him. His eyes refused to open too, glued shut. His entire body felt numb. Was that the right word?
I'm sorry.
Images rushed through his mind. Sneaking from the castle with his brother. Meeting the enigmatic Ghazi leader named Zer, who gave him the spear. The attack by the ice bear. Garin's bravery. And then...
"By the frozen gods! Did I really? Was that really?" It couldn't be. It couldn't.
But it was, Archer knew. It was him, and it wasn't. He could still see what he'd done, the destruction he'd wrought. But it was like watching a stranger wearing his face. A heavy sigh from his father.
If I'm being honest, I'd hoped he wouldn't be cursed either.
You know I hate that word. Cursed, Archer thought. Are they talking about me?
I know.
Stop.
This single word was spoken by neither Archer's mother or father. Yet the voice was familiar, one he'd heard recently. The last voice he'd heard before he lost consciousness on the snowfields. It was his uncle, Bane.
I know darkness. I know violence. I can help you.
His uncle's words came back to him then, sending icy dread through him. He wanted to shiver, but his body refused.
I know this is hard for you both, Bane said slowly. You have your demons, as do I. But you were not born with them. I was, just like your son. He doesn't need comfort or compassion. He needs truth.
What truth?
Another tadpole of cold fear swam through Archer, as he remembered something else, a memory he knew he'd been ignoring until now. His brother, Garen. His blooded face, his chest ripped open.
No.
His uncle was wrong. He didn't need the truth. He didn't want it, not if it meant...
Brother, the Queen said. He saved Garen's life. The healers barely got to my son in time. If they hadn't...
Her words trailed away. But Archer didn't need to know the rest, because Garen was alive, and that was enough for him. The utter joy that filled him was sufficient to finally allow his eyelids to flutter open, his lips and tongue working once more.
Ugh,
he groaned, his tongue dry, the inside of his mouth like sandpaper. His mother's face appeared quickly, her eyes filled with concern. She cupped his cheek with her hand, which was warm.
Archer, you're awake.
He couldn't find the word for a second.
Cursed?
She shook her head and he saw the tears that sparkled. His mother rarely cried, and it frightened him more than anything.
What is wrong with me? You are special, like your father. I don't understand.
You will. The important thing is that your brother is safe.
You saved his life. But the bear... I couldn't stop. Just like with Garen. I don't know how to stop. There was this...
How could he explain without sounding like a madman?
There is this voice in my head, Mother. It tells me to murder and destroy, and, oh yeah, it screams like a banshee, too. Isn't that nice?
You will grow used to the voice, son,
his father said, his broad face appearing on the opposite side.
What? How could you know that?
Something his mother had said finally clicked in his mind.
You are special, like your father.
He sat up rapidly, bringing his hands up before him, palms down. His fingers began to shake, and his mother covered them with her warm hands, tucking them beneath the covers. She hadn't been fast enough, though, and he had seen. His skin was pale and glassy, free of the tiny hairs that had once grown there. And through his skin he had seen the black veins, bulging upwards like little snakes. Suddenly he couldn't breathe, even though his mouth was open, and he was sucking at the air which was gone, drawn from the room by some force that was not of their world, or so it felt.
What am I? What am I? What am I?
The door opened and Archer looked up, finally spotting his uncle, who was standing in the corner. Lisbeth Lorne entered, but stopped when Archer's eyes fell on her.
How does she know I'm looking at her?
Her blue eye flared on her forehead, and she murmured,
Shadows in his soul. Father?
Archer's voice seemed to come from a faraway place, even to him.
What does she mean? What's happening to me?
Son, There's something you need to know.
Epilogue 2. Falcon Hosa. The Southern Empire, Fenir. Circa 548. Falcon Hosa, once the emperor of the famed and infamous Empire of Fanes, read the letter with interest. He always enjoyed getting news from the Four Kingdoms, though as an ambassador of Fenir he often travelled across the borders. He still spent much of his time in the Great Canyon City. This message was from the north, and contained the surprising news that one of the Gaeric Shiri children, the eldest, Archer, apparently shared his father's gift. At least, that was the term being used. Falcon had only met the great knight, Taryn Shiri, once before, and he couldn't help but to be intimidated, given the man's sheer size and unnaturally pale skin. Falcon wondered if the boy would grow even larger than his father, the thought making him chuckle slightly. "What is it?" Falcon's companion said, looking up from the message she'd been hunched over for the better part of an hour, the pair passing the early morning in comfortable silence. Shanti didn't look up as Falcon's gaze fell upon her. Her tongue was out slightly, emerging from the corner of her mouth the way it always did when she was concentrating. Her quill dipped and dived, scrawling words across a long portion of parchment that was now mostly filled with words to her best friend, Sonica Vade, who was currently living in one of the border cities, Gem City, with her brother Gat and her squad of peacekeepers, the Black Tears. They were trying to quell another uprising, something that was becoming more and more frequent in the south. Not for the first or last time, Falcon wondered why Shanti was with him and not the Black Tears, the group she'd dedicated so much of her life to serving. Not that he minded. He'd loved her for a very long time, a love that, unfortunately, she'd never been able to reciprocate, at least not in the manner he wished for. He drank her in with his eyes, though he didn't need to. He'd long ago memorized her every feature. He could almost predict what she would do next. There. She lifted one of her hands to tame a stray lock of coppery hair, tucking it behind her ear. In the early morning light, her skin looked more pink than red, and he longed to run his finger along the shape of her jawline. Her lips were a temptation he only refused, because he couldn't bear to scare her away. Losing her would be akin to losing himself. Alas, he knew, her heart was forever with another, one who was as unreachable to her as she was to him. They didn't live together, not exactly, for such a thing was for lovers, not friends. But their caves were directly beside one another, separated by a few feet of stone that could be crossed in a moment. When they were both in Fenir, they took turns crossing to each other's homes in the morning, spending hours in enjoyable companionship, talking sometimes, other times not. What they did mattered not, at least not to Falcon. All that mattered was that they were together. Some of Falcon's friends, including Sonica, regularly labelled him a fool for pining after someone as distant as the stars, but Falcon cared not. In the stories he read, such patience was rewarded one way or another. Aye, sometimes such tales ended in tragedy, but there was always that fleeting moment of immeasurable joy before the end. He would die a million deaths for such a moment with Shanti.
"I will wait for you," he thought. "Always."
Just then she looked up, furrowing her brow. "Didn't anyone ever tell you it's rude to stare?" she said. She was joking, he could tell, her eyes sparkling like the emeralds her people, the Terrans, had once mined when they were enslaved by his father.
"It's just..."
"Just what?" she asked, and her eyes grew sharp, a challenge in them.
"You're so beautiful. You have a spot of jam on your chin."
She laughed.
"Do I?"
She wiped at her skin, removing the smudge that had been there long after they'd finished their breakfast. He'd wanted to kiss it away the entire time, which was why it had taken him so long to read his messages, distracted to his limits.
"You got it," he said.
"You never answered my question. What made you laugh before?"
Shanti was an ambassador to Tarragon, and so she spent much of her time at sea and in the lands even further south than Fanes. Whenever they were both back in Fenir, they swapped stories of the goings-on in their respective areas.
"The eldest prince of the north is going to grow at least as large as his father," he said.
"Truly?"
Though Shanti had never met Sir Shiri, Falcon had described the knight to her in great detail.
"He shall be as tall as a mammothin."
"And as strong to boot."
Shanti smiled and turned back to her letter, finishing it with the flourish of her signature. The scroll was so long it would require 3 stream workers to send. Falcon hesitated before voicing the question on the tip of his tongue.
"Shanti,"
he started, his voice growing husky. He'd only asked her this thing twice before. The first was a year after the battle known as the Fall of All Things, and she'd grown angry, refusing to speak to him for a long few months afterwards. The second time was 5 years ago, and instead of becoming angry, she'd looked sad. So sad. He hated seeing her that way, which was the primary reason he'd waited so long to ask her again.
"Will you be my wife?"
"Falcon,"
she said, looking up with eyes he could drown in.
"Don't. Please. Don't ruin things."
Oh, gods, how he wanted to be hers. But he didn't want to destroy what they had. It would have to be enough.
I'd better get to training,
he said. Satisfied, she smiled and stood, going to him as he did the same.
"As should I,"
she said, kissing him once on each cheek, the embrace of dear friends and nothing more. Never more.
"Goodbye, Shanti. See you tonight."
Her smile broke him in two, but the pain was worth it. Would always be worth it.
"Yes,"
she said.
"Of course."
Falcon made his way to the place that had once been his home, the palace passed down from dozens of generations of Hoses. After the Fall of All Things those many years ago, Falcon had relinquished the empire, calling for a new and radically different form of government, one the 4 kingdoms had never seen before. Instead of a single ruler, they had devised a system of various delegations, each with equal voting power. To Falcon, it had seemed like the fairest way of making decisions, as each member of society had a voice through the elected officials for their area. However, as the years wore on, animosity between delegations grew, and recently there had been rebel uprisings when decisions were made that went against one or more of the parties. It was the job of Sonica's Black Tears to quell such uprisings, a strange change for a group that had once been rebels themselves. But Sonica believed in the fairness of the new system, so she did everything in her power to maintain peace. Falcon, however, wanted nothing to do with it. He might have been born to be a leader, but that didn't mean he wanted to be one. If so, he would have remained emperor. Passing through the Phoenician marketplace, he easily forgot the cares of the realm, getting lost in the familiarity of the world he'd grown up in, the tantalizing spice-infused smells of smoked pison and roasted nuts, the brightly coloured silk scarves, dresses, and other clothing worn by most women, the malleable leather armour favoured by men, a group of women dancing fen sir. Falcon was surprised to see several men in their midst, performing the graceful forms unabashedly, others practising fen ru, the martial art of attack, twisting and turning with power and agility, and still more training at Fen Lu, using the fluid motions to defend against invisible foes. Though war had been absent from the 4 kingdoms for many years now, Falcon was glad to see his people's traditions carried on with such vigour. He reached the palace, which was now known as the House of Order, a place for the delegates to meet and vote on the issues of the day. Though the uprisings had been growing in frequency and strength, the grounds behind the white-painted walls had thus far been unaffected. The guards opened the gates ahead of him, and he couldn't help but to enjoy the respect his name and past station granted him. He enjoyed his other job, the one he performed while home in Fenir. As a master of Fen Ru, he taught the children of the delegates the art of attack. On the opposite side of the palace, Shanti would soon begin her own training, for those of the children who'd selected to learn Fen Sir. Most of her students were girls, while almost all of Falcon's were boys. The final group learned Fen Lu and was comprised of a mixture of both genders. They were taught by a woman who'd once been one of the Black Tears. Falcon approached his students, who were already stretching and preparing for the few hours of training ahead of them. When he clapped his hands and then placed his fist over his heart, they straightened up, formed a line, and mimicked the gesture. He walked down the line, inspecting each boy in turn. There was only a single girl, a 9-year-old named Ava, who was as tough as any of the boys, perhaps tougher. Her father was a delegate from the Terran district, and though her mother was Phoenician, she favoured her father's coppery hair and reddish skin. He stopped in front of her, admiring her form, the confident positioning of her raised chin. He moved on, firming up some of the boys' stances, noting leather that was smudged or unclean. None of the Phoenician martial arts were only about physical movement. No, they were about overall cleanliness, spirituality, and mental strength. These precepts had been lost during his father's reign, but finally Falcon felt like they'd been brought back to the forefront, a small victory.
"In a week's time we shall compete in the annual Fenru-Lu-Sir tourney," Falcon said. "Are you prepared?"
"Yes, Master Hoser,"
the 13 boys and one girl said in unison. It had taken a while for Falcon to get used to the title, Master, considering the connotation the word had once held. Now he clung to it as a shining example of how far they'd come. It no longer meant master of slaves, but educator, teacher. He shook his head.
"No, you are not."
He was pleased that none of them flinched or turned their heads to look at them. Their obedience was impressive, a testament to their progress since joining his group. Back then he could barely get them to pay attention for more than a few minutes.
"But you will be. At ease. Face your sparring partners."
The next few hours passed quickly, a mix of sparring and instruction, culminating in a free-for-all battle, where Falcon determined who was eliminated. At the end, the girl was the only one left standing. She'd accomplished the same several times before, but Falcon could still tell it irked the boys.
"Use your failure to motivate you," he said. "Even a defeat can be a victory if you respond to it correctly."
The group disbanded, and Falcon, against his better judgment, left to see if Shanti had finished up yet.
"Why do you torture yourself?"
he thought, though he already knew the answer.
"Because I love her."
Love. It was something that seemed so simple in the books he read. There were always obstacles, of course, but the pairs were determined to break them down, no cost too great. But what if the cost of love was never getting to enjoy it? Was it worth it then?
"Yes," he thought. "For Shanti, I will be broken forever."
He climbed a marble staircase, determined not to be seen. Sure enough, over the balustrade in the courtyard below were Shanti and her students. Opposite to Falcon's group, they were all girls save one, a boy who carried himself with a willowy grace that was equal to that of the dancing girls. His breath caught, because Shanti was dancing with her students, performing an example of each step, each movement, pausing between each to offer instruction. If she was not a woman, she would be the wind and the rain and a ray of sunshine combined into one being. She transcended beauty and grace. And yet, shadows continued to cling to her eyes, her expression. It was a stark reminder that she had a dark past, as they all did. And then her eyes found Falcon's, and he was caught in the act. He expected her to frown, to fire darts from her eyes, but she didn't. No. Instead, she smiled. Though it might have been his imagination, he thought he saw the shadows lift from her face just a little. 1 week later. Thousands had flocked to the grounds of the House of Order for the tournament. Not only would the delegates' children be competing, but all trainees from across the realm, some travelling as far as from Gem City or even Iris, the furthest Phoenician city from the capital. The night before, Shanti and Falcon had hosted a dinner with Sonika and Gat Vaid and the rest of the Black Tears, who had arrived earlier that day. Now, the peacekeepers were spread throughout the crowd as a reminder that this event would remain civil. Amongst Falcon's students, there was an air of nervous excitement. They had worked hard over the last year. The final week had been particularly brutal, as Falcon had extended their training hours each day until he was satisfied that their preparation would be unmatched by any save Shanti. Each class would face another class, the students participating in single combat until all from one group had been eliminated. The format made for a long day, with victors from the outer rings moving toward the inner rings, until the finalists were left to fight in the center circle. Falcon spotted Chanti and her students making their way through the throng, wearing all black. Though they were marching in step, there was no stiffness in their gait, their movements lithe and graceful.
"It's as if she's created a dozen miniature versions of herself," Falcon thought with a smile.
Chanti's gaze drifted to meet his, and she returned his grin, though hers was filled with a competitive fire he'd rarely seen in her over the years. He was thankful for the martial arts. In a way, they'd brought her back from the dead.
"And me, too," he thought.
Once Shanti's students had passed by, he refocused on his own, giving them last-minute instruction and words of advice.
"Enjoy the moment,"
was the final thing he said to them, for no tournament was worth it if you didn't have a bit of fun. His first three students to fight were all defeated by boys trained outside the House of Order. Each gave it their all and did him proud, however, and he hugged them as they wiped away tears before anyone could notice. One of the parents of the boys approached.
"You promised us victory,"
the man said sharply.
Falcon stared at him. He was a delegate from Guavia, one of the wealthier districts in the city.
"I said your boy would learn to fight with honor," Falcon replied, keeping his tone even.
The man shook his head.
"There is no honor in defeat," he spat. "Not the way you're doing it," Falcon said.
Behind the man, his son stared dejectedly at his feet, his eyes still wet.
"I will see you are stripped of your job. Do as you will," Falcon said, turning away.
Despite his confident response, he felt a shred of fear enter him. It was not an empty threat coming from this particular delegate. He held some sway with a large portion of the other delegates, and might very well be able to follow through. Falcon enjoyed his job and didn't want to lose it. He also wasn't certain of whether the man was referring to his other job, too. Being an ambassador was something he loved equally. To lose both in a single moment would pain him greatly.
"Don't think about it," he thought. "Think about your students. This isn't about you or that bitter man. This is about them."
His next two students emerged from the circle victorious, and it brought a swell of new excitement from his group. They had a short break, and he led them to watch one of the other bouts, between one of Shanti's girls and a boy fighting in the style of Fen Lu. The battle lasted the better part of an hour, as the boy was content to defend against the graceful attacks by Shanti's student. Falcon pointed out the various techniques used by a practitioner of Fen Sir. At the same time, he watched in wonderment as the techniques, once known as not more than a dance, came alive in the form of beautiful yet powerful attacks. If not for Sonica Vade's vision all those years ago, they might not be here today. Finally, the young girl found an opening in the boy's defenses and slipped through like water through a sieve, taking him down and pinning him. A subdued cheer arose from Shanti's students, while more raucous celebration erupted from the area of the audience that was likely made up of the girl's relatives and friends. Falcon's gaze was drawn away by a commotion in another part of the crowd. A fistfight of sorts had begun, but was quickly ended when two of Sonica's black tears arrived on the scene, dragging the men apart. Falcon sighed.
"Why do people have to ruin things?"
He glanced back and found Chanti had ushered her students away from the scene. He followed her example and did the same. The tension was high. Most, if not all, of the students from each school had been eliminated. Falcon was proud to have two combatants remaining. The girl, Ava, and a tall, rail-thin boy named Ko, who was much stronger than he looked. Shanti had only one competitor, the same girl who had outlasted the boy before the commotion had occurred. Since then, the crowd had been remarkably subdued, though it felt like the calm before a storm as the stakes grew. There was no monetary prize for the victor, but that mattered little to these Phoenicians. For them, it was all about pride and victory. For their children. For their district. Phoenicians had long held battle and war as a measure of their identity. Now that there was relative peace across the four kingdoms, the annual tournament was the closest thing they had to that old life. Falcon watched as Shanti's lone student dismantled a very capable competitor from one of the outer districts. She did so with ease, which led Falcon to believe she'd been holding back previously.
"She was just warming up before," he realized.
It was just like Shanti, he knew, to counsel her best fighter to lull her competitors into a false sense of security.
"Like a spider in a web, waiting patiently."
When the fight was over, the girl walked back to her master, who spoke to her in quiet tones. There was no celebration, none of the usual excitement that came with victory. Only a gritty determination that showed neither female believed one win was enough.